This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In art and pop culture, effeminate men are cast in two very different lights. Some are revered, like pianist Liberace or drag queen and TV star RuPaul, but other times effeminate men are seen as loathsome and grotesque. Author and teacher Harry Thomas Jr. set out to discover how these men can occupy such different spaces. He explored the writings of Truman Capote, the music of Big Frida, and more subtle takes on effeminate men like sparkly vampires in the Twilight series. He collected the history and legacy of these men in a new book called Sissy, The Effeminate Paradox in Postwar U.S. Literature and Culture. Harry Thomas Jr. is a teacher at the Durham Academy in Durham, and he joins us now. Harry, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Tell us how you got interested in this subject.
I was in graduate school at UNC Chapel Hill, and I knew I wanted to work on something in 20th century American literature, and I kept being astounded by how often I would come across stuff in books I was reading that framed effeminate men as negative, as bad, as pathological, as the worst possible thing you could be. The James Dickey novel Deliverance was a big kind of eye-opener for me. It literally seems to suggest that, you know, the fate of working in an office building where some of your coworkers are women is like a worse fate than being hunted and killed and attacked and brutalized out in the wilderness. And that seemed insane to me. And so I originally set out to write a book about how much American culture hated effeminate men. And I went and had lunch with a grad school friend, and we were talking about our dissertations, and I said, I'm going to write this book and blah, blah, blah. And I used the phrase, the specter of the sissy. And she said, that's great. That's a great title. That's your book title. And so I was all excited, and I was going to go write this book about how much America hates effeminate men. And then I had that moment that you have when you research, and I read Michael Kimmel's book, American Manhood, and realized that someone had already written that book, you know, 15 years earlier than I had. And he, even on like page 86 or 87, uses the phrase, the specter of the sissy. So I was really enormously crushed and thought that I had no ideas. And I was medicating my grief about my big research plans falling through by watching a lot of RuPaul's Drag Race on TV. And that somewhere in the middle of that, I thought, wait, how are both of these things true? How is it that effeminate men are so hated and feared and loathed? And I have all these examples in American literature of that being true. And yet RuPaul has a career. And then sort of the more I started thinking about that and trying to research that, I thought, you know, and someone like Liberace, this, you know, the pianist who had this incredibly over-the-top, campy, effeminate persona with, you know, glitzy candelabras and white mink coats and the whole nine yards. You know, Liberace made more money in the 50s, you know, than the Beatles and Elvis did at the same time, you know, when they were alive and recording. And so I just, the book grew out of me trying to answer that question. How is it that both of these things are true?
Is it worth talking about what we mean by effeminate? Because clearly people know it when they see it, but how do we define it?
I define it in the book as men who dress, act, move, behave, talk in ways that are deemed feminine. And I try to make the point that, of course, what counts as feminine and what counts as masculine is culturally constructed and changes from time and place to time and place. I always talk to my students about, I always show them that famous portrait of Louis XIV, you know, with his silk stockings and little kitten heels that he's wearing, and point out to them, right, that in a given time and place in France, that was what was considered masculine, although it certainly would be considered hyper-feminine today. So it's culturally variable, but men who present in ways, behave in ways, act in ways that are coded as feminine at a given time and place.
We are going to get to this paradox, and particularly how we would explain the phenomenon where some men who are clearly performing an effeminate role are over-the-top successful with wide audiences. I'm going to talk about that, but let's go back to this question about 'twas ever thus and was it ever thus and why we are so obsessed with making these clear delineations between masculine behavior and feminine behavior. That was not always that way. Something has happened to make us more sensitive to that.
lots of different things, I think, have happened to that. Certainly Michael Kimmel's argument is that the marketplace has a great deal to do with that. And when we move as far back as, like, you know, slightly after the American Revolution, when we move away from the founding fathers like Jefferson and Adams and Madison and those guys, and we shift to a market economy, that men now have to prove themselves. It's not about, like, who your dad was or what your last name is. Men now have to prove themselves in the marketplace. And I think that – I think he's right that that feeds a great sense that masculinity is a thing that has to be competed for, that has to be earned, that has to be maintained. And that, you know, sadly, I think to many people's great detriment, you know, we've also sort of – the alongside of that, we've evolved these rules that, you know – folks who fail, men who fail to maintain their masculinity, right, are punished and singled out in really harsh ways.
And let's talk about some of the things that go along with that. So not only you move to capitalism and a market economy, competition, proving yourself in the marketplace that you are a male. Industrialization means the things you used to do to perform masculinity are become easier and easier. Now women and children can do it. Oh, my goodness. What does it mean to be a male? So by the beginning of the 20th century, anxieties are building in. You can read it everywhere about what it means to be masculine. And office jobs, right?
Yeah, those anxieties last it's not like they end in the early 20th century. James Dickey's Deliverance, that novel, I think, is from 1970. Yeah. And that's the essential anxiety of that novel, right, is like now that men work office jobs that require cooperation and creativity rather than competition and dominance, what becomes of manhood? How does one prove themselves as a man?
And is that when we see the rise of the sissy and the concern over effeminate behavior? Is it
the first big panics about sissies as a pathologized type are late 19th, early 20th century. There's a lot of panic about immigration. There's a lot of panic about white manhood in the country. You have groups like the Boy Scouts, founded quite explicitly to masculinize American white boys and make sure that American white boys grew up appropriately masculine, that they weren't sissified by city life.
When you talk about pathologized, what are the ways in which this is manifest? How do we see the sort of the execution of the sentence that you must be male or female?
A wide range of penalties. You know, effeminate men and boys pay a wide range of penalties, from mocking and teasing and joking to outright physical violence. One of the things that really stuck with me as I was working on the book was the murder, I think this was in 2008, of this kid Lawrence King in California, who was shot and killed by a classmate at his school. And a lot of the coverage focused on the fact that Lawrence King was effeminate, that he wore lipstick to school, that he sometimes wore skirts or women's jewelry. And I was really struck by that case and followed a lot of the coverage of it. And I made the mistake of reading comments sections on stories about that, where people said things like, well, it's a shame what happened, but he should have known better, you know? And I thought, what a unbelievably hideous thing to say, right, about a murdered 14 or 15-year-old. Like, really, lipstick or a skirt is a big enough thing that to justify the murder of a child? That seemed really shocking to me.
So what about the exceptions to this, these performers that you talk about, Liberace? I mean, I would include Elvis Presley. You talk about Little Richard in the book. These ideas that there is a way you can perform as an effeminate man and be quite successful.
Yeah, the project of the book was what I finally settled on was trying to find and illuminate this tradition that I think already existed in 20th century American literature of writers and artists who had framed effeminacy in a very different way, and who had framed effeminacy not as a negative difference but as a positive one. Moments where effeminate men and boys were framed as powerful, desirous, figures who could enliven an otherwise sort of dull social scene, figures who could provide tremendous erotic power, erotic attraction. The book is about trying to kind of identify that tradition and trace it out from about 1940 up to the present.
Well, let's talk about some of the characters that you do raise in the book. Truman Capote, for one. You talked about writers and his role in all of this.
Yeah, so I talk about Truman Capote's first novel, Other Voices, Other Rooms, which comes out in 1948. And it's a really remarkable rewriting of what had been a really popular genre, which was called the boy book, which was a very popular genre in late 19th and early 20th century America. If listeners know Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, that's the kind of, you know, the most famous, boy book, in the sense that it's about a kind of rough and tumble boy who's seeking to evade women who want to civilize him and make him behave and clean him up and fix his behavior. And the boy book, you know, were these coming of age stories where these rough and tumble boys find male role models and sort of become socialized as men. Capote in Other Voices, Other Rooms reverses that trope. And you have the main character in that book, Joel Knox, who goes to he's been living in New Orleans with his deceased mother's family, but he's called home to visit his father's family in a really tiny small town in Louisiana. And he finds that his father is a paraplegic who can't really talk and do much, is not much of a role model. And the role model he gloms onto in that book is this guy named Cousin Randolph, who is a gay man and a drag queen. And the kind of closing image of that book is Joel looking up into the house and seeing Cousin Randolph in drag. And the book ends with him sort of walking towards Randolph. And so instead of the kind of typical boy comes of age and becomes a man, it becomes this sort of boy comes of age, becomes a drag queen, and that's not seen as, you know, Capote doesn't present that as something hideous. He doesn't present it as a failure. He really presents it as a positive outcome, a good outcome for Joel.
And of course, the book is a success. So it's, and Truman Capote is a success. People accept him as a writer, and yet he's somebody who presents effeminate behavior and is a successful writer.
Very much so, much to the irritation and aggravation of Gore Vidal, another big 20th century American writer, who really attacked Truman Capote and said, attacked Capote for his effeminacy and said, you know, Capote gives people what they expect. They expect gay men to be effeminate. Vidal had a very different take, and Vidal writes this book, The City and the Pillar, that I write about elsewhere in the book, you know, and Vidal worked very, very hard to separate male homosexuality from effeminacy. Capote takes a very different path.
So there's a conversation going on, say, within a gay community. But again, as we take a look outside, heterosexual or nominally heterosexual audiences are consuming this without the kind of judgment they might pass on a classmate or a coworker.
Yeah, that was the fascinating thing about Liberace to me when I started digging into Liberace and researching his life and career. It seems ludicrous to me, given how much we know about him now, and we know that Liberace was in his personal life a gay man. But the persona he projected all through the 50s, 60s, 70s, really even into the 80s, you know, he was steadfast in his commitment that his public persona was straight. And it was marketed to fans as straight.
How important? So that was critical. In other words, you all need to know that I'm straight and this is just an act. And therefore, since I'm over the top, that's why you've come to see me. Safe for everybody. You're all safe for loving me. I'm a straight man. I'm just acting wild.
Yeah, the word safety you use there is really important, because what struck me about female fans' reaction to Liberace was that Liberace provided this fantasy of heterosexuality, where a heterosexual guy would really love straight women and be attentive to their feelings and care about them, but without the fear or the risk of physical aggressiveness. I mean, that's really what women responded to in droves.
And men, again, let's talk about a little more subtle character, and that would be somebody like Elvis Presley, who really did project a very masculine image. Bevy's lots of women screaming and following him. So, okay, once again, for all the male audience, he's safe. He's one of us, right? But on the other hand, the way he performed was definitely effeminate. That was his charm.
Absolutely. And he was mentored by Liberace. It's Liberace who kind of took him aside early in his career and told Elvis to, wear sequined jackets to sort of amp up the theater of his stage show. So I think Elvis learned a lot from Liberace. And I think the appeal of Elvis, absolutely, you know, Elvis, absolutely heterosexual, but that enabled him to, you know, dance in ways that probably most men in the 1950s weren't told that they could.
Absolutely. And it was part of his success. What do you think is going on there? Why is it that the male, let's just talk about the men in the audience who loved Elvis and, and bought his records and thought he was great, went to his concerts, are watching this kind of performance that they know they better not do in school and at work, right? You can't be bouncing your hips that way, and those lips better not be like that if you're going to play football, right? But yet it's perfectly okay for me to go and enjoy this guy. What do you think is happening subliminally, or do you not want to get into the consciousness of somebody who's watching and loving this guy, knowing that this is something? What is it about the performance that attracted those men? That's really what I want to know.
I think I would say that there's something to do with, and I think this is why in the book, in addition to a lot of literary works, I do come back to a lot of moments of performance. But I think there's something about the aspect of performance, right? You've bought a ticket. There's a kind of set start to it. There's a set end to it. You're there to see a show. And so I think that effeminacy is more permissible in those contexts. I think also if you look at, I mean, I can't speak to individual Elvis fans, but I think, you know, two performers I do look at in the book at great length, Liberace and then the Sissy Bounce rapper, Big Frida. I think their fans are drawn to and appreciate the kind of otherworldly options that are opened up in those performances, right? The rules of gender and sexuality and what a man can and can't be and what a woman can and can't be or can and can't do. Those things start to get slippery within the bounds of that performance, and I think that's really attractive to a lot of people.
You also talk about, quote, boys who sparkle is a category in your book. Tell us more about that.
Sure. So my argument is that Liberace is the kind of foundational figure for a type that I call boys who sparkle, and that's men who perform a similar kind of feminine masculinity as Liberace does. So example, the other big go-to example that I talk about in the book is Edward Cullen, who is the vampire love interest in the really popular young adult novel series Twilight, the Twilight series, which was also made into movies. Boys Who Sparkle are men who are, at least the persona is resolutely heterosexual, but they are effeminate and they offer a kind of emotional sensitivity and care and concern for women's well-being without the threat of physical violence. And so my argument is that the Edward Cullen character in the Twilight books works in exactly the same way that that Liberace did for his fans.
Does literature work in a fundamentally different way or have different rules that apply than, say, pop culture, film, and music?
That is a really good question. I don't know that there are fundamentally different rules. I think in both cases, there's that element of fantasy or performance or otherworldliness, which I think authorizes or eases a kind of, it eases an easing of the rules, the typical rules of gender and sexuality.
Does the success in any of these fields suggest to you a kind of longing for a much more fluid understanding of gender, which certainly predates, this is not the way it's always been. Most of human history has been much more fluid. We're locked into this. Are you seeing a desire to get past this?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that the tradition I try to outline in the book is a series of writers and artists speaking to exactly that desire, speaking to the fact that humans are really, really complex and complicated and multifaceted, and that the little boxes we build for ourselves and say, you know, men should do these things, they can't do these things, that those things are really, really limiting. And I think they're especially limiting for men. You know, I think we tell men over and over again that they can't be emotionally vulnerable, they can't show weakness in any way, they can't ever fail at anything. It's a really terrible standard to have to live up to. And I think there's a lot of desire for some kind of other option.
Harry Thomas Jr., author of the book Sissy, The Effeminate Paradox in Postwar U.S. Literature and Culture, also teaches at Durham Academy. Harry, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a total pleasure.
Just ahead, we preview images that depict African-American life in urban Appalachia through the lens of photographer Isaiah Rice. And you'll hear that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.